right, go ahead and have a seat. Good morning. Justice Grosky may stay standing because she has a back problem, and it's easier for her to stand. So make nothing of that other than the fact that that's her preference right now. All right, we also have Bigfoot High School here from Walworth County. Can you stand up so we can say hello to you?
Look at that.
Wow, that's good proof. All right, well, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you are able and want to stay after oral arguments, Justice Dallet will be available to speak with you. She won't talk to you about the merits of the case, but she can talk to you about proceedings, and you can ask her anything your heart desires. So go right ahead and do that. And challenge her. She likes that.
I don't have to answer.
All right. Go ahead and have a seat. Welcome. Calling now 21 AP 1673, Joshua Call versus Frederick Crane. Appearances, please. Morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Dr. Crane appears in person. I was counsel of the Park for Shelley and Investments.
Good morning, Your Honor. Brian Bolton on behalf of the Wisconsin State Legislature.
All right. Good morning to all. The lineup that I have is 25 minutes, followed by 15 minutes each for counsel over here and 5 minutes on rebuttal. That's a correct understanding? Great. Let's proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Resolution of this case turns on a simple question. What authority does Dr. Crane currently have to remain in office? The statutes are perfectly clear on this point, that his term expired May 1, 2021. The statutes are equally clear that he has no holdover authority. Under the statutes, he has no authority to be in office right now. We hear much about the common law, but the common law only gets him part way. In this case, there are two independent bases to conclude that Dr. Crane is unlawfully in office. First, at the expiration of his term, a vacancy arose.
What statute says that, counsel? Because to me, your biggest problem here is, was there a vacancy? Okay. So if you can show me a statute that creates that, that would be very...
Certainly, Justice Rogan said. I will address the vacancy question just right after I preview the second basis, which is the removal.
Or right now.
just to put my marker down, Justice, the vacancy question only arises once we get to the common law. The statutes are clear that Crane's term expired. Crane has no statutory authority to be in office.
The statute that limits his term does not use the word vacancy in the whole statute.
That's right, Your Honor. It says his term shall expire.
Right.
And after the expiration of his term, he points to no statutory authority to remain in office.
That's not my problem. Is in order for Ms. Nass to be appointed, there has to be a vacancy. Okay, if his expiration of the term of office doesn't create it, I haven't been able to find it. That's my
problem. And I think it's important to recognize that there are two separate issues here. There is the appointment of Ms. Nass, mm-hmm. But before that, I think it's important to be very clear here, there's no statutory authority for Crane to be in office right now. So, and I will address your question right now, but I think that is the very important backdrop to the rest of the discussion, is that under the statutes, his authority is lacking. So to get
someone be a holdover then?
That gets us to the common law, Your Honor. And to be in office right now, or to purport to be in office right now, Dr. Crane has to rely on the common law. And he says, I have a common law right to hold over. And the common law is clear on that point. There is a common law holdover right. But We're not talking about statutes here. We're talking about common law. And the common law comes in two parts. There's the holdover rule, but there's also unquestionably in the common law the vacancy rule.
But counsel, we also have the Constitution, which speaks to vacancy, and we have the statutes which speak to vacancies. So I think the Constitution and the statutes override the common law with respect to that question. Would you agree?
I think importantly that what the Constitution says is that the legislature may declare vacancies. And the legislature has done so, but it doesn't say that the legislature defines all vacancies.
It gives the legislature the power to do that, and in fact they have done that, and we have all been looking closely at 1703, vacancies, how cause. And the biggest problem with your argument, counsel, to pinpoint it for you, is that sub 10 of that statute says if the office is elective, the incumbent's term expires. So there we have an express declaration by the legislature that upon the of an elective office's term that a vacancy is created. But that statute doesn't address at all an appointive office. And I think somewhere in your briefing you made the argument that we have to give meaning to the absence of language. You didn't argue it with respect to the absence of language there. But how do you account for the absence of, under the definition of when vacancies occur, the absence of any provision declaring that an appointive office's expiration creates a vacancy?
There are a number of points, Your Honor, that address the absence of an explicit statement in 1703 that the expiration of an appointive term creates a vacancy. The first is the background principle of the common law. The common law, since the Plunce decision and actually before the Plunce decision, has recognized that this court used the term the expiration of a fixed appointive term necessarily creates a vacancy. So that's the backdrop against which the legislature was listing enumerated vacancies in 1703. The common sense, common law rule that at the end of a fixed term, a vacancy is necessarily created. The addition of the elective expiration provision in 1703, I think it's important to recall how that came to be. That came to be as part of an election law overhaul. And we've seen in a letter filed just this morning, or just last night rather, some legislative history about that. I think, first and foremost, it's questionable whether that's supplemental authority at all. But that legislative history doesn't say anything about why the elective expiration provision was added. So we have the common law. We have the addition of this elective expiration provision, not really saying anything about why it was being added other than being part of an election law overhaul. And then we have the reality that appointive terms are a varied type of statute. There are different types of appointive terms. There are appointive terms like Dr. Prehn's that are for a fixed, definite term with no statutory holdover provision. There are the holdover provisions that refer to until a successor is qualified, until a successor is appointed, until a successor is confirmed. There are indefinite appointive terms. So the lack of a provision in the vacancy statute referring to appointive terms doesn't say, I think, what the other side would have us believe, that it absolutely means that the legislature concluded that the expiration of an appointive term does not create a vacancy.
Well, the legislature also wrote in sub 13 of the statute I just referenced, any other event occurs which is declared by any special provision of law to create a vacancy. I searched the statutes and I don't find any declaration by the legislature in the statutes that upon expiration of an appointed term that a vacancy is created. And I don't think we look to the common law, do we, when the legislature, pursuant to its constitutional authority, has defined when vacancies occur.
As we're reminded from the other side repeatedly in briefing, the legislature legislates against the common law, and the legislature is not presumed to easily overrule the common law. And the common law vacancy rule for appointive terms was absolutely clear at the time that 1703 was enacted. So the fact that there isn't a specific enumeration in 1703 is not at all dispositive of the vacancy question here.
Attorney Karp, at the top of 1703, it says vacancies how caused, and then there is the phrase, except as otherwise provided. How does that phrase play into your analysis?
Yes, Justice Karofsky. I think that except as otherwise provided is particularly important in light of this court's decision in Thompson. In Thompson, the court said that there was no statutory provision recognizing the expiration of an appointive term, just as Justice Bradley was getting at, that it's not in the statute, so it must not create a vacancy. After Thompson was decided, the legislature added this except as otherwise provided provision. So seeing Thompson say that we don't see anywhere in statute that the expiration of an appointive term creates a vacancy, the legislature added this as otherwise provided.
So the legislature, when it says as otherwise provided, they're talking about as provided by law, which is provided by statute. You know, and I get your reliance on Thompson, though I think there are some wrinkles in there. I am troubled because I can't find a vacancy in the statute. I mean, if the sections on expiration of this office said they create a vacancy, the word vacancy is not in there. So you have to try to point me to a statute that says there's a vacancy. I know you want to talk about he shouldn't be holding this office, but we're only fussing about that because the governor has appointed somebody else, and that person has been qualified by filing her oath of office, correct? So that's the only reason we're fussing. But the governor can't really make an appointment into a position that's not vacant.
Well, first, Your Honor, I will save you the time. We're not aware of any other provision that says a vacancy arises in statute.
Okay.
The fact is that the more important statutory question is Crane's current authority to be in office. And the statutory history here is what tells us that
even if you kick him out, you can't get the governor's appointee in unless there's a vacancy. So I guess if you pull him out in quo warranto, then you got a vacancy.
So, Your Honor, if he's out, the office is unquestionably vacant. If he's out, there's nobody in the office. There's no question that an unfilled office is a vacant office. And at the expiration of his term, that office became vacant both by common law and we think fairly read by current statutes. As we've discussed, the statutory history after Thompson strongly suggests that the legislature was making this except as otherwise provided change to address the situation created in Thompson, which was, I think, importantly, contrary to existing common law. This is further confirmed in the provisional appointment statute.
Do you think except as otherwise provided is referring to something other than the statutory law? You think that references the common law?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, let's turn then to 17.20, the provisional appointment statute. Of what import, then, is that as you leave the discussion of 1703?
So 1720 sub 2 is important because it represents what is now the only provisional appointment authority, whereas at the time of Thompson, there were two separate types of provisional appointment. Mm-hmm. There was the provisional appointment authority under which the court said, well, the legislature is not in recess, and so the governor's appointees can't yet take office. The backdrop to that, what was effectively a constitutional failsafe, was what was then 1422. And 1422 said that once the legislature is out of session, the governor can make a provisional appointment. What that did was avoid the sort of constitutional conflict that would arise if the situation that Prain and the legislature urge were the rule. And that is, at the time of Thompson, the longest that a provisional appointee would have to wait was 2 years until the legislature went out of session. Here, if we accept the legislature's and Prain's view, that's indefinite. The legislature, with an agreeable former appointee, could stall the next appointment as long as the legislature chooses under the current provisional appointment statute. But importantly, when the provisional appointment statutes were changed, that is, 1422 was repealed and the legislature moved that fail-safe provisional appointment authority into what is now 1720 sub 2. And what that did was we acknowledged that that provisional appointment authority is tied to whether a vacancy occurs, but that change recognized that the vacancy included the situation at issue in Thompson. That is to say, the provisional appointment authority that is now in 1720 sub 2 contemplates the governor appointing provisionally somebody to fill a vacancy. And that's necessary, as we suggest, based on the reading of the vacancy statute against the common law, but also as a matter of constitutional avoidance, because what was then a failsafe in 1422 is now the entire provisional appointment authority in 1720 sub 2. So it's necessary to construe 1720 sub 2 to include the type of appointment here.
How do you respond to the argument, I'm not sure if they're going to make it, I'm going to ask your friends on the other side, that you don't need a vacancy to confirm a successor?
Your Honor, that argument I think is a bit puzzling because it rests on a vacancy statute. That argument is grounded in 1720 sub 1, and it says that there's this other procedure to fill vacancies, or rather to fill an office, but it points to the vacancy statute. So that's a problem. The other problem is 1720 sub 2 is the vacancy procedure for the governor's appointment. 1720 sub 1, on which they rely, is the general appointment statute. The governor has a separate appointment procedure under 1720 sub 2. Just
in 1720 sub 2, it says the governor, with the advice and consent of the Senate, appointed. Okay, so that phrase in the middle of subsection 2 has been troubling to me because it says vacancies occurring in the office of any governor officer normally appointed by the governor and with the advice and consent of the Senate appointed. It's almost as though you have to have the advice and consent of the Senate under 2 to be appointed. Can you see what's bothering me? It's just in the phraseology.
Your Honor, I think there the reference to advice and consent of the Senate appointed is referring to the nature of the office.
Say it again.
That's referring to the nature of the office. So
the nature. Okay.
So for offices that are okay. Filled by appointment of the governor with the advice and consent of the Senate, okay. These are the types of offices for which the provisional appointment authority applies.
But thank you. That was very helpful.
I think on the point of provisional authority or provisional appointment authority, in addition to the context of the vacancy statute against the backdrop of the common law, there's also legislative history that indicates that when the legislature was moving that provisional appointment authority from 1422 into what is now 1720, The legislature was contemplating the governor having the authority in all instances to make a provisional appointment, and all instances including a vacancy on the expiration of an appointed term. And this is clear in the legislative history. The bill analysis in 1977 recognized that the provisional appointment authority applies unless the appointee is to replace an official who has not resigned and is serving for a fixed term which has not yet expired, and the appointee may take office immediately. So what the bill analysis is saying is that once a term expires, this new provisional appointment authority authorizes the governor to make a provisional appointment, in effect superseding what the court said in Thompson. And while we're on the point of Thompson, it is, I think, an elephant in the room to address. In our brief, we've discussed that there are statutory pathways to distinguishing Thompson. But as I've discussed here today, Thompson stands in conflict with a long strain of common law. And while Thompson certainly could be distinguished, I think to leave it in place and decide solely on the basis of statutes would do a disservice to the common law. And so we're therefore asking the court, if the court agrees with us on the vacancy question, to clear away Thompson and overrule that portion of Thompson that said the expiration of a fixed term does not create a vacancy. Unless the court has any...
Are you switching to a different topic?
I was going to go to removal, but if...
I was going to ask you about removal.
Okay.
So go right ahead.
So entirely separate from the question of whether a vacancy arose, it is the removal authority. And here we're under 1707 sub 3. 1707 sub 3 says that certain officers have for cause protection at certain times. And it says that state officers serving in an office that is filled for a fixed term have for cause protection. Now, the way that this statute is written, the present tense formulation tells us that for cause protection applies only during a fixed term. That is to say, at the end of Prane's fixed term, that limited for cause protection ended. And this is, I think, clear enough in this statute alone, but this is confirmed when we compare sub 3 to subs 1 and 2.
So would you agree, counsel, though, that the only reason that Dr. Prane is still serving in this position is because of the original fixed-term appointment?
Your Honor, Dr. Prane certainly is not serving a fixed term.
The only reason he's in the position in the first place is because he was appointed for a fixed term.
I agree that at one point he was appointed for a fixed term. That fixed term has ended. And so he no longer is serving a fixed term. He is now serving what is effectively an indefinite term.
But the statute says serving in an office that is filled by appointment of the governor for a fixed term by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, and all of those things applied, which is the only reason that Dr. Prane took that office in the first place.
So to read the statute as referring to the office as opposed to the current status of the officer not only, I think, disregards the present tense formulation, but it importantly disregards surrounding statutes and disregards the statutory history of the for cause protection. So sub 2 is of the type, Justice Bradley, that you're referring to. It looks at the nature of the office. Sub 2 says state officers appointed by the legislature are removable at pleasure. So regardless of the current status, it looks at how they were appointed. Sub 3 is different, and it says officers serving in an office that is filled. So it doesn't look to the nature of the office. And I think even perhaps more important than the comparison to sub 2 is what sub 3 used to say. So sub 3 used to read the same way that sub 2 does. It used to refer to those officers appointed by the governor with the advice and consent of the Senate. So it used to focus on the nature of the office. That has since been changed to the present tense formulation that we see now.
Wouldn't your construction do an end run then around the Senate's advice and consent function in the statutes?
Not at all, Your Honor. The Senate has no advice and consent function as to removal. And in fact...
No, not with respect to removal, but if Dr. Prehn at this point is only at will serving at the pleasure of the governor, or in this case, the displeasure of the governor, as has been made clear, he could be removed at will, a provisional appointment could be made, and that provisional appointee could hold the office indefinitely, and that's doing the end run around the Senate's advice and consent function.
Not at all, Your Honor. The Senate is sitting on the provisional appointment right now. There's no end run. The appointee, the governor, the state is waiting on the legislature to act on this provisional appointment.
My point is the governor doesn't have the authority statutorily or constitutionally to put into this position anyone he wishes to put in this position because it is statutorily subject to the advice and consent of the Senate. In other words, the Senate has the right to approve or not approve the governor's appointee.
First, Your Honor, I think it's important to distinguish the appointment analysis from the removal analysis. And the removal analysis unquestionably does not involve advice and consent. And the appointment analysis would be governed by the provisional appointment statute, which contemplates the Senate's advice and consent after the appointment is made, after the appointee takes office. This is the statute that the legislature wrote. This is how the legislature contemplated giving its advice and consent after the appointee begins work in the office. There's no attempt to make an end run around advice and consent here.
Counsel, I wanted to just ask a little bit about the constitutional arguments you make. And I care about the original understanding of the Constitution and how we apply it. When you go back to some of the history here, it seems that the governor had was understood to have very little in the way of appointment powers. Some of the early historians of the Constitution, Professor Rainey, who lives here, I think, and resident Wisconsin legal historian, talked about the governor was given no appointment powers, and the delegates made clear they didn't want him to have that kind of power to exercise extensive patronage. If you look at some of the early laws that were adopted, governor's powers were very, very limited. The very first Board of Regents that was enacted was appointed entirely by the legislature, and the governor had very little authority in relation to that. So I wonder if you just respond to some of the, I guess, historical evidence that suggests when it comes to this sort of thing that we're not in a place where we default to the idea that this is just execution of the laws and within the sort of lane that is exclusive executive power.
I see that my time is up.
You may answer.
So with regard to the original common meaning, I think the record is fairly sparse on this particular question, but I think significant guidance comes from what the federal courts have recognized about the understanding of the executive authority and the executive power to remove. And that removal power, the United States Supreme Court has recognized, is quintessentially executive. And if the court accepts what I think should be an unquestioned proposition, that the head of a department in the executive agency is a core executive officer, that this removal authority, this authority to determine who will faithfully execute the laws, is squarely within the executive's authority and cannot be encroached by the legislature by interference with the removal power.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, counsel.
Morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Attorney General Bronson La Follette, in his opinion about holdovers in a point of office, distinguished between the prescribed or statutory term, the fixed term, and the personal term that any incumbent might actually end up serving. General Bronson La Follette noted the personal term could be either shorter than the prescribed or fixed term, or longer. It could be shorter for any number of reasons, death, resignation, removal. It could be longer if the appointed official held over. In his opinion, he also distinguished, because by that point, 17.03.10 had been enacted. So in that opinion, he also distinguished between appointive offices where holdover is permitted and elective offices where the legislature prohibited holdover, declaring that upon expiration of a term in office, the elective official's office is vacant.
Counsel, do you need a vacancy? Is a vacancy required to confirm a successor?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason is, if you look at 17.20, sub 1, it refers to that vacancies may or shall be filled by appointment by the appointing power in the manner prescribed by law for making full or regular full-term appointments, which tells me that there is a such thing as a regular full-term appointment process.
So just let me follow this through. So if you don't need a vacancy to confirm a successor and Preen holds over and is in his second term or whatever it is that he's in, because it's not really a term, and he has for-cause protection at that point, how can he be removed?
Sure,
Your Honor. Or how can the better question is, how can a successor ever be appointed? It doesn't, I mean, those holding those two things together don't seem to make a lot of sense.
Well, sure, Your Honor. The answer is that the regular full-term appointed process can unfold at any point, any point after the fixed term in office has expired. See, I view the fixed term in office as protective of the incumbent, not as a limitation on the term.
But you also view that even after they've held over, they're also protected by good cause. So you want it always.
They are protected from removal by the governor. They have to be able to meet the for cause standard. That's correct, Your Honor.
How many fixed terms does an appointee get?
There is no limit, Your Honor, assuming that they went through the regular full-term appointment process, they could be reappointed any number of times.
So even though the statute says that a term is 6 years, we just read that out of the statute, and Dr. Preen, has a lifetime appointment.
No, Your Honor.
And along those lines, how do you get out of the fact that it expired? What do you do with the word expire?
Sure, Your Honor. Once an official's fixed term has expired, then the regular full-term appointment process is available. The governor can nominate, and then the Senate can, perfect the appointment by confirming that nominee.
How can they
can
do
then
that
qualify.
If you're telling us there's no vacancy?
Because I don't think there's a vacancy necessary, Your Honor. I think any time after, as Dr. Prane's term has expired, the governor may nominate, and then the Senate may, with its advice and consent, effectuate the appointment. So right now, if the Senate chose to give its advice and consent to confirm the governor's nominee, then Dr. Prane's personal term in office on the Natural Resources Board would end, and the successor would become the incumbent.
Is it fair? That goes to Justice Rogenczyk.
No, please, go ahead. That's fine, Justice Brett.
Is it fair to say that the provisional appointment power applies only in the case of a vacancy?
Yes, Your Honor.
I was just going to follow up. I think your argument, as I understand it, is that that the governor or the appointment process, in this case, can be used to not only fill a vacancy, but to fill somebody who's a holdover, essentially, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I want to go back to what Justice Bradley just asked. You said that the provisional power is only in the case of a vacancy, yet there's no vacancy at the end of a fixed term of 6 years that is expiring. So how could a governor ever appoint someone provisionally?
Well, the governor cannot appoint someone provisionally unless there's a vacancy, Your Honor.
Okay.
But you're talking in a circle.
This seems like a circle, right. And I'm lost in the circle.
Okay. Well, I'll try to explain. There are two types of appointments under Wisconsin's law. You have the regular full-term appointments that are, they're kind of scattered around in the statutes, and then you have 17.20 that tells us there's two options for the appointing authority, in this case the governor, when a vacancy arises. Under sub 1, the governor can choose to use the full-term regular appointive process. Nominate somebody, the Senate confirms that person, which appoints them, and then they qualify by taking their oath or posting their bond or whatever it is they have to do to qualify. The governor also has the option in the case of certain offices, the ones where, where the governor dominates and then with the advice and consent of the Senate, the appointee is appointed. That's available, the interim process, the interim vacancy process. For those types of offices, but it's not mandatory.
Are you talking about something that the statute calls a provisional appointee?
I'm sorry. Yes, you're right, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, don't be sorry. We're all trying to work through these statutes. But it does say that a provisional appointee who qualifies, which Ms. Nass has because she's filed her oath of office, which is what it takes to qualify. Correct. It says that during the time in which she qualifies, she's eligible to exercise all powers of office. How do you square that with the fact that we have Dr. Prehn in office?
Sure, Your Honor. The interim vacancy process under 17.20 sub 2 is only available if there is, in fact, a vacancy. So Ms. Nass has not been appointed yet because the Senate has not provided their advice and consent.
But a vacancy is not required to make an appointment. I mean, I don't understand how there's ever a provisional appointment. It makes no sense to me.
Well, sure. If anybody on the Natural Resources Board were to resign or move out of the state or...
Then you have a vacancy, and they're listed under the statute. So hypotheticals don't help us. We got a real-life controversy that's troublesome. I don't know how you effectuate all of the provisions of sub 2 where it says a provisional appointee may exercise all of the powers and duties of the office to which the person is appointed during the time in which the appointee qualifies. Now, if the appointment is made and rejected by the Senate, then it lapses. When it lapses, there's a vacancy. So I don't see how you say there's not a vacancy before and square that with the fact that the provisional appointee exercises all the powers and duties of the office. Can you kind of square those up for me?
Well, sure, Your Honor. I think that, the idea of having from my perspective, an interim vacancy section, sub 2 of 17.20, is to prevent the interruption of the function of government bodies, to prevent the interruption of services to the people.
So are you saying that there can never be a provisional appointment when someone is a holdover?
Correct, because there's no vacancy.
So you're not saying that Dr. Go ahead. Thank you. But you're not saying Dr. Prehn is a holdover, correct?
No, he is a holdover.
Mm-hmm. He is a holdover.
Oh, yeah.
Even though there is nothing in the statute that expresses that for this appointment, he's allowed a holdover. And I'm looking at 6605172A, which may, after this case, have become my favorite section of the statute because it talks about local weed commissioners, which I didn't know we had in Wisconsin, but apparently we do. there is a specific provision when it comes to local weed commissioners that it says they shall hold office for 1 year and until a successor has qualified or the local executive determines not to appoint a weed commissioner, allowing for a holdover, which doesn't exist in this statute where it says that once it got to be May 1st of 2021, Dr. Prehn's service on the Natural Resources Board was over. So there's no holdover provision in the statute, or that shall expire, and that's from 1507.1c. So why don't I see that in the statute if he's a holdover?
Because the common law rule for holdovers has really been the common law rule in Wisconsin forever, as far as I can tell from my research. And I think, Your Honor, it just kind of goes in and out of fashion. You know, the Thompson v. Gibson case involved at least one appointed official whose appointive statute did contain an explicit holdover clause.
Well, when am I supposed to know when I'm reading through the statute where a holdover is and where a holdover isn't? I know it's with the weed commissioner, but I don't see it here for the Natural Resources Board. So what I'm hearing you say is if it's in the statute, it's in the statute. If it's not in the statute, go to the common law so there's always a holdover.
That is the law in Wisconsin right now between the few statutory provisions that provide for explicit holdovers and the common law that provides that any appointed officer may hold over until their successor is appointed and qualifies. So again, here, as soon as Dr. Prehn's successor is appointed through nomination by the governor and then confirmation by the Senate, then that will start the new term for his successor. His term is not infinite. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Please finish.
That was all.
Okay. I wanted to return to the line of inquiry that Justice Rogensack initiated with you because I think there's a logical connection, but there's lots of statutes that we're all looking at. So we don't get to the provisional appointment statutes unless there's a vacancy. So that brings us back to the earlier line of discussion about when has the legislature declared a vacancy, right? So, again, going back to 1703, sub 10, we have a provision saying if the office is elective, the incumbent's term expires, that's a vacancy. The statute is silent with respect to appointive offices. So we don't even get to the provisional appointment statutes in this situation because there is no vacancy. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the provision I think that Justice Rogensack was referring to is 1701 sub 13. If the governor makes a provisional appointment under 17.20 sub 2, then we get into the appointee qualifying for office. But when I go back to 17.20 sub 2, which I've now lost.
Do you want
to? Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And I need my cheaters.
You want mine? You might be able to see better. More clearly.
This 17.20 sub 2 refers to interim vacancies. Vacancies occurring in the office of any officer normally nominated by the governor. So we aren't under that statute because we have not established a vacancy.
Correct, Your Honor. And my argument is that the regular appointive statute in Chapter 15 applies. And the governor may nominate and the Senate may effectuate the appointment by providing its advice and consent.
So if a vacancy isn't required, why can't the governor appoint someone during a fixed term then? It seems to me that that would mean the governor could do it anytime they want it.
I think that's exactly the point of the fixed term, Your Honor, is it prevents the opposite, call it a problem, a friendly governor and a friendly Senate coming in and remaking a board, the Natural Resources Board, overnight as they see fit. I think that the history of Wisconsin's conservation agencies supports the argument that the conservationists wanted to insulate the conservation, then the Conservation Commission, which became the DNR and the NRB.
Insulate them from what?
From the governor, because what happened, Your Honors, I forget the name, it's in the brief, governor dismissed the Conservation Commission summarily and installed the person that he wanted, because apparently it was his friend and needed a job. And the conservation interests felt that really set them back. So in an area like conservation, the important decisions.
So the remedy for that, under your argument, is lifetime appointments?
Not at all. No. There's no lifetime appointment, Your Honor.
Well, there could be for Dr. Prehn. I mean, who's to say he's not going to serve on that board for the rest of his life? And looking at the thousands of agencies, I mean, the detailed in the appendix of the thousands of agencies and the amount of people this affects, that all they have to do is just stay put till the end of their life.
I disagree, Your Honor, because I'm sorry, I see my time is ending.
You may answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. In theory, the holdover incumbent could continue for the rest of their natural life. But that supposes that the governor and the Senate will continue to sort of give each other the cold shoulder, and the governor will refuse to nominate someone the Senate will confirm, and the Senate will continue to refuse to take up the nomination. And it just doesn't seem likely that that condition that we have right now will continue into perpetuity.
How about 10 years? No.
Good question, Your Honor. I couldn't put a...
Okay. Your time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you even get into your argument, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question on that. We have decades of history. I think both of your briefs identified five instances under Republican and under Democrat governors where there have been holdovers, and I think, based on what I read, the maximum holdover time was about 3 years?
4 years.
Thank you.
Okay, a follow-up on that. Have we had this kind of blanket holdover in our... I mean, this was a rare thing that was done. It was assumed when you were done with your fixed term, in this case fixed six-year term that's staggered, according to 15.34 sub 2A, that you would leave. We now have people... multiple people in multiple places, and after this case potentially could be, like I said, thousands that can then potentially hold over. Wouldn't that history be changing a little bit based on what this court says?
Not at all, Your Honor. If the court sticks by Thompson, which was decided in 1964, which aligns with 11 attorney general opinions going back to 1903, five Republicans, four Democrats, you would simply be reaffirming what has been the law of Wisconsin since the beginning of Wisconsin.
What has changed is the Attorney General's position in this case. Is that accurate?
That is correct. It's a change in position from, as I said, 11 previous Attorney General opinions. I'd like to make one important point. Even if you think that Thompson is wrong, even if you think Thompson should be set aside, notwithstanding stare decisis, the Attorney General's position is still incorrect, and here's why. The legislature is presumed to know the law when it passes statutes. Not only that, it is presumed to draft statutes according to the interpretive rules that this court sets, unless it says otherwise. We play by the rules you set unless we explicitly reject them. It is indisputable that, right or wrong, Thompson announced a rule of interpretation. That rule is that if you, legislature, create a board and you set the terms of the board members to be fixed, we will understand that unless you explicitly say otherwise, incumbents in those positions may hold over until their successor is appointed and qualified. And appointment means nomination and confirmation. To answer Your Honor's question.
Qualified is different than confirmation.
Correct.
Qualified is defined in the statutes, too.
Correct. An appointment is defined as gubernatorial nomination, Senate confirmation.
Where is that set out?
1507. Advice and consent creates the appointment. So against this backdrop, 3 years after Thompson is decided, the legislature passes a law creating the Natural Resources Board and creating the six-year term. It did not explicitly reject the rule in Thompson, so it is presumed not to have rejected it. In fact, there's good reason to believe that because they clarified the common law rule as applied to elective offices, that under the canon of expressio unius, they understood themselves not to be altering the common law rule as applied to appointed positions. So it wouldn't be just a matter of overruling Thompson to hold that the Attorney General is correct. This court would need to red pencil the vacancy statute and do what the legislature declined to do over the dozen times it has amended that statute since Thompson was decided, including in 1983 when it reached out, regulated on this subject matter by clarifying the rule as applied to elective offices, but leaving the rule undisturbed as to appointive offices.
Counsel,
mm-hmm.
There's something that causes me to say this just isn't workable. And, of course, I look at Thompson. One of the criteria for overruling a case is unworkable in practice. push back, and I'm sure you will, Mr. Walsh, push back on the idea that it's just not workable for government. I'm not talking about hardball politics. I mean, both sides of the aisle play hardball politics. But it just undermines the, I'll go so far as to say, separation of powers or the function of the executive. If the executive, regardless of the party, is thwarted to be able to place in appointed positions those who are going to effectuate or enforce the law, which is a core power, of course. So, you know, the reality is we don't know what's going to happen in future elections. We don't even know what's going to happen necessarily to our recent redistricting decision, right? But odds are that we're going to have a pretty lopsided legislature for the next 10 years. And we just can't, government doesn't function. It's not workable. So respond to that.
Your Honor, this isn't the first time in the history of our republic that the Senate has not held a hearing on a nominee on the governor's schedule. The Senate has confirmed north of 40 of the governor's nominees. This is not a constitutional crisis.
North of 40? He's in the third year of his term. How many have they not confirmed?
Or even held a hearing on?
Do you have any idea what that number is?
Well, is that part of the record?
Was 40 part of the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I believe so.
If it's not part of the record...
Oh, it's certainly judicially noticeable.
Okay, can we...
Then is the absence of it judicially noticeable as well?
I don't have the exact number on the ones that they haven't.
Well, I think if it's judicially noticeable that they have confirmed 40, that the opposite, the number that he has...
Sure, it would be judicially noticeable.
...that the Senate has not confirmed, we could also take judicial notice of. It's way more than 40. I can't even... Exponentially more than 40, I'm going to venture to guess. But go ahead.
Your Honor, the framers of the Wisconsin Constitution, in their wisdom, entrusted these interbranch disputes to the political branches. This is a quintessentially political question. It is not a question for the courts. There are times where there are impasses between governors and legislatures, and they often work them out, and sometimes they don't, and the government continues to work as it is working now, which is why part of the reason there is a holdover rule and has been since the beginning.
So how do you respond to the argument that was made by your friends on the other side that, fine, vacancy-wise, maybe there's a holdover, maybe government continues to work, but what about the core power of the governor to remove? What about the core power that's being interfered with if then somehow for-cause protection exists in a holdover?
So there's the statutory question. There's no ambiguity. The for-cause removal protection applies to the category of office. But if you're asking, is that statute unconstitutional, which the Attorney General is not arguing, the answer is no. And it has to do with the rule in Wisconsin, which is that the legislature is allowed to exercise oversight over boards and agencies, because boards and agencies are creatures of the legislature in the first place. They exercise powers only because the legislature has created them. And part of the way the legislature exercises oversight is through exercising its advise and consent role under the Constitution, which it does often by holding hearings, often by confirming, but sometimes not, because it doesn't consent to the nomination. And it's important to remember there's a board, but there's also the Department of Natural Resources. All the power of the department is vested in the secretary. That secretary has been nominated and confirmed.
Mr. Walsh, what if the Senate were to hold a confirmation hearing and then deny this appointment? Then what would happen?
If the nominee is voted down, then the nominee cannot take office, because then the nominee would not be appointed.
Would there be a vacancy?
There would not, because... I don't know. It depends on what Dr. Brain would do or what any incumbent would do in that situation. It would be under the rule of Thompson, under this court's rule, it would be the case that unless there's a statute vacating him, the only thing that can vacate him is you know, the situations enumerated in 1703, resignation, et cetera, or Senate confirmation, which would oust the incumbent and replace the incumbent with the successor.
Where does it say that?
Which part?
The second part.
Okay.
Because under
the vacancy?
Under your theory, right, no, under your theory, Dr. Prehn gets to stay there until it's a lifetime appointment. And then even if the governor appoints someone else and there is a hearing and someone else is appointed, where does it say that Dr. Prehn has to leave the position? How could we
law that this court declared in Thompson, which accords with the common law rule, which accords with 1720, is that the confirmation of the successor creates an appointment. Nomination plus confirmation equals appointment. Appointment ousts the incumbent. I like to think of it as ousting by eviction. Once the new person is confirmed, the office holder is ousted, and the new person comes in. That's what this court said in Thompson. It also follows from 1720. 1720 says, appointees to fill vacancies shall hold office for the residue of the unexpired term or if no definite term of office is fixed by law until their successors are appointed and qualified. So it has to be that when the successor is appointed and qualified, the successor takes the office and the former holdover is ousted.
But qualified
doesn't
mean
that.
Qualified does not mean confirmed.
I know. Yes, Your Honor. And I'm glad you asked that question. Because I used to think that qualification meant confirmation. That's not what it means. Qualification is oath, but appointment is not mere gubernatorial nomination. Appointment is nomination plus confirmation by the Senate. That hasn't happened here.
Then you make 1720 sub 2 redundant in itself by that interpretation. And the only way it makes any sense is if it applies only to people who are being appointed in the middle of a term. So say somebody dies in office or just decides they want to retire, and so the governor makes an appointment midterm.
Yeah, if any one of the 13 enumerated scenarios under 1703 occurs, then a vacancy occurs, and now the governor may make an appointment pursuant to that provision. So 2 does work.
Right. So 1720 sub 2 occurs only for interim appointments.
Correct.
So part of the council, I think, you know, it seems like, as I understand your argument, you sort of have four categories of people here. You have, you know, people who are appointed in official, you know, appointed and with consent. You have people who might serve as holdovers after being appointed. Then you have people when there's a vacancy who might have a provisional appointment and therefore have the powers to serve until such time as they're confirmed, right? And then you have vacancies, right? And all those sort of trigger different things. Part of the complication here in the statute is that this holdover category isn't really discussed. It's reflected in our law, it's reflected in our history, but it's not discussed, and I think that makes the statutory interpretation maybe more complicated than it would be otherwise for some.
I suppose it could make it complicated. I would suggest it makes it easier, and the reason is that the legislature passes laws against the backdrop of this court's jurisprudence, and we presume that it does. We have good reason to think that in 1983 they were aware of this court's jurisprudence, and what they left unsettled, or what they left undisturbed, was the holding in Thompson.
Go ahead.
Which is why statutory stare decisis has so much more bite, especially when the legislature is actively passing laws on the subject matter that this court has issued a holding on.
So you can do it. You can do, I think under the law, as I understand it, that you're arguing, you can do an appointment here to fill a vacancy. You can do an appointment when there's a holdover, which displaces the holdover at that point. And I suppose if you had a provisional appointee, they could be removed or rejected, or they could be confirmed one way or the other.
That's right. That's right, Your Honor.
So, counsel, there's a number of statutes, one of which was referred to by Justice Kravsky about the weed commissioner, but there's a number of those statutes that talk about, that include language of specific holdover. I'm going to make an assumption, but I will check it later, that some of these were also passed after Thompson. So why is there one was? Okay, one was.
Or pre-Thompson, which is important because Thompson confronted one of the five appointees in Thompson had a holdover provision. And so the other side argued, wait a minute, this holdover provision suggests that where there isn't one, you can't hold over. Court said, nope.
Okay, well,
not true.
There's one, and the legislature makes it as the backdrop of Thompson. So in one case, they use specific holdover language, yet here we do not see specific holdover.
It's the Recycling Council, and I expect that the reason the legislature added that after Thompson is because Thompson said it could. Thompson said, if you want to make it even more clear that an officer may hold over, you can do it. And that's the rule you gave them, and they followed the rule.
Okay, so they...
And you might... Sorry, go ahead.
That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Your argument is they didn't need to put that in with respect to this statute because that was already the common law, and it was... Thompson was there. So, but they chose to do it in another statute also passed after.
That's because this court blessed a belt and suspenders approach, which was taken with respect to the Recycling Council. Maybe that was because the legislature wanted holdovers with respect to less important commissions, because it's hard to find people. It's hard to find people to sit on the Recycling Commission.
Even though they're already going to be holdovers. They can hold over anyway.
This court said, if you legislature want to make it even more clear, so the legislature's taking your rules of interpretation as a given. So it isn't necessary. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, there's been a suggestion that the provisional appointment statutes upon vacancies in 17.20 is kind of gutted by the construction of your friends on the other side. But there's actually multiple circumstances where the governor can make a provisional appointment, right? When under 1703, there's 13. When the incumbent dies, resigns, is removed, ceases to be a resident of wherever the person needs to reside, if the person is imprisoned or convicted of certain crimes, if the election is voided, if the incumbent neglects or refuses to perform his or her duties, I could go on and on. But there's many, many circumstances where the governor can exercise his provisional appointment authority, right?
Yes, and thank you, Your Honor. I think that that highlights a particular absurdity of the other side's position, which is that in all of these other circumstances, for example, a death on the same day as the end of the term, or if the incumbent gives a resignation letter or doesn't give a resignation letter, that determines the executive's authority to make a provisional appointment, that the vagary of the delivery of a letter or whether somebody dies or any of these other circumstances arise is what decides whether a vacancy exists for the provisional appointment authority to take effect.
But that's not quite true because it's actually the statute that is defining when the vacancy occurs.
And
the legislature chose not to say, you know, could have added a 10A or a 14 if the office is appointive when the incumbent's term expires, but it didn't do that.
Certainly it didn't, Your Honor, and I think as we've discussed at length here, against the backdrop, as the other side urges, the legislature legislates against the backdrop of the common law, which was clear that a vacancy creates, or the expiration of a term creates a vacancy. And to give meaningful effect to the provisional appointment statute, the legislature recognized as much when they transferred the provisional appointment authority to what is now 1720 sub 2.
Are you challenging the constitutionality of the advice and consent provision of 1507?
Not at all, Your Honor. As I said earlier, we're not challenging anything about advice and consent. We're waiting on advice and consent.
The reason I'm asking is because there's been a suggestion that there's a separation of powers problem here and that the legislature or Dr. Prehn specifically is intruding or encroaching on the governor's powers. But, of course, the advice and consent provision is also, by that same score, an intrusion on the government's on the governor's powers to appoint.
And that is an intrusion that the federal courts have recognized, that the United States Supreme Court has recognized, that type of intrusion can be problematic. In Wisconsin, we don't have that situation. We're not saying that the legislature's setting of terms or granting for-cause protection within a fixed term is problematic. It's when the legislature steps out of its lawmaking role and takes control of the process outside the fixed term, that is where the encroachment occurs. And I see that Justice Hagedorn was waiting for a question.
I'm just going to, if you don't have a problem with the idea of for-cause removal or those sorts of things, which, by the way, goes all the way back to 1849, the governor, again, had very limited appointment authority, both to appoint or to remove under the original constitution and the laws that were enacted. How do you get to the argument here that this creates any kind of constitutional issue? This seems like this is one of those areas that under the Constitution, as at least it was drafted in Wisconsin, which is different than federal law, admittedly different than federal law, there's pretty broad authority given to the legislature and has been from the very beginning of our state with these types of issues.
Your Honor, I think that that issue is addressed in the legislature's lane, that the legislature in Wisconsin is allowed to impose those removal restrictions during term. That's the type of authority that the United States Supreme Court has said Congress doesn't have. In Wisconsin, that's acceptable. But once we're outside of the legislature's lane of making laws, setting fixed terms, we're talking about the legislature getting involved in what is, other than that limited component, a core executive function of removing officers who...
Well, let me just push back. I mean, I understand the statutory argument, and outside of the statutory argument, you have your statutory argument, and I understand that. But putting aside your statutory argument, you're arguing that raises a constitutional issue because this is core executive power. And I guess what I'm trying to push on is that I don't see any evidence that the original understanding of the Wisconsin Constitution places this kind of appointment authority within the core executive power. And quite in fact, it looks like a good chunk of that power is given to the legislature and understood to reside in the legislature from the very beginning of the state.
If I may, Chief Justice.
You may.
Now, Your Honor, what we're talking about here is unquestionably the power to faithfully execute the laws. What the board does is to determine the actions of a core cabinet agency. That cannot be encroached by the legislature. There's no indication that I'm aware of that the legislature would have some hand in deciding who those core executive officers would be, and more importantly here, after the executive decided that one of those who's been charged with faithfully executing the laws is no longer doing so, that the legislature could decide that that individual must stay in office.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you for your arguments. Thank you for coming today. Justice Ballard, she'll be out shortly if you're able to stay. The court will convene in closed conference.
Can we do one?
1 o'clock.
No? Okay.
Let's talk back there.